Chapter 10. As soon as the polished brass elevator doors opened on the Oregon's lowest deck, Juan Cabrillo felt the pulsing beat against his chest. It wasn't the ship's revolutionary engines producing the throbbing presence in the carpeted corridor, but rather what had to be the most expensive stereo system afloat. To him, the music blaring from the only cabin in this section of the freighter sounded like a continuous explosion with a voiceover track that seemed to mimic a dozen cats fighting in a burlap bag. The wailing rose and fell in no relation to the beat, and every few seconds feedback from the musicians' amplifiers would shriek. Mark Murphy's taste in music, if this could be called music, was the reason there were no other cabins in this part of the Oregon. Cabrillo paused at the open door. Members of the corporation had been given generous stipends to decorate their cabins any way they saw fit. His own was done in various types of exotic woods and resembled an English manor house more than a nautical suite. Franklin Lincoln, who had had nothing growing up on the streets of Detroit, and who had spent 20 years in the Navy sleeping wherever they told him to, furnished his cabin with a cot, a footlocker, and a pressed metal wardrobe. The rest of his money went into a customized Harley. Max's cabin was a mishmash of unmatched furniture that looked like it had come from Goodwill. And then there was Mark and his partner in crime, Eric Stone. Eric's room was a geek's fantasy, with every conceivable video game console and controller. The walls were adorned with pinup girls and gaming posters. The floor was a static dampening rubber that was crisscrossed with a couple thousand feet of cables. His bed was an unmade pile of sheets and blankets tucked into one corner. Mark had gone for a minimalist vibe. The walls of his cabin were painted a matte gray with a matching carpet. One wall was a video display system nearly 18 feet across and composed of dozens of individual flat screens. There were two overstuffed leather chairs, a queen-sized bed, and a stark chest of drawers. The room's dominant feature was the speakers. The four of them stood 7 feet tall and resembled Frank Gehry's Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. Murph claimed that sharp angles in a speaker system affected the sound. Considering the garbage he listened to, Juan wasn't sure how his young weapons specialist could tell. Murph and Stone were standing in front of the video display, looking at satellite imagery provided by Langston Overholt. With the Oregon driving hard for Libya, Cabrillo had finalized a contract with Lang to act as a covert search and rescue group and had gotten his people thinking about what they would find once they reached their destination. He had also asked for the raw satellite imagery that he was certain the National Reconnaissance Office had obtained within a few hours of Secretary Catamora's disappearance. Mark and Eric had altered some basic pattern recognition software to help them search the imagery for a downed aircraft. The NRO had a dedicated staff of dozens doing the same thing, with hardware and software more sophisticated than what was at his people's disposal, but Juan was confident they would find the downed 737 first. Juan flipped the light switch to get their attention. Murph pointed a remote at the stereo rack and muted the system.
"Thank you," Juan said. "Just so I don't buy the CD by mistake, who was that?"
"The Puking Muses," Mark replied, as though Cabrillo should have known.
"Yeah, no way I'd make that mistake."
Mark was wearing ripped jeans and a shirt that said Pedro for president. His hair was a tangled dark mane, and to Juan's surprise, he had shaved off the scraggly whiskers he called a beard. Eric was in his customary button-down shirt and chinos. Cabrillo touched his chin and said,
"About time you got rid of the dead bird on your face."
"This girl I'm chatting up on the net said I'd look better without it."
Mark's cockiness had returned following the chairman's rebuke over his mistake in Somalia. Sam Pryor, the wounded engineer, said he harbored no ill feelings but was going to make Murph his personal valet once he got out of medical.
"Smart woman. Marry her."
"So what have you got so far?"
"Wait, before you answer, what is that?"
He pointed to the map on the screen where the Sahara Desert met the Mediterranean, about 50 miles west of the recognizable urban sprawl of Tripoli and its suburbs. Where the coastline usually ran in a fairly even stroke, there was an area where the sea pushed inland in a perfectly shaped rectangle. It was obviously a man-made feature, and from the scale on the monitors, enormous.
A new kind of tidal power station, Eric said. Just came online a month ago.
I didn't think the Med has high enough tides, Juan mused.
It doesn't.
But this power station doesn't rely on the ebb and flow of the tides. The place they built the plant had been a narrow-mouthed bay that was much deeper than normal for the region. They built a seawall across its mouth and pumped it dry. They then expanded the dried-out bay so it was wider and deeper than it was originally. There's a series of sluice gates running along the seawall near its summit and sloping downward. During high tide, water pours through the gates, down pipes, and turns turbines to produce electricity.
That doesn't make any sense.
Eventually, the old bay will fill with water. I don't care how big they made it.
You're forgetting the location.
Eric had a little smirk on his face. When he'd first read about the project, he had intuitively grasped the facility's secret. When Juan stared back blankly, he added,
"The desert."
The chairman suddenly understood.
Evaporation. Brilliant.
The reservoir had to be wide and broad, but not necessarily deep. They calculated typical evaporation rates to get the right size for the amount of electricity they wanted to produce. By the time the sun goes down in the evening, the artificial lake is virtually empty. Then the tide rises, water pours in through the powerhouse, and the cycle is repeated.
What about the
excess salt? It's trucked away at night and sold to European municipalities as a de-icing agent for roads. Completely renewable, clean energy, with the bonus of a few million dollars a year in road salt.
There is a potential problem, Mark said.
Over time, the excess evaporation could change weather patterns downwind from the site.
The report I read said it would be negligible, Eric said, defending the project from Mark's natural paranoia.
That report was written by the Italian company that developed the plant in the first place. Of course they're going to say it's negligible, but they don't really know.
Not our problem, Cabrillo said before Mark could ramp up one of his conspiracy theories.
Finding the secretary's plane is. What have you got so far?
Murph chugged half a can of Red Bull before answering.
Okay, we've got a couple of scenarios. Number one is the plane exploded in midair, either the result of a catastrophic failure like TWA 800 over Long Island South Shore, or a missile strike, also like TWA 800, depending on who you believe. If that's the case, then we would have wreckage strewn over 100 square miles when we factor in the plane's speed and altitude.
It would be nearly impossible to spot any of it without knowing approximately where the event occurred, Eric said, wiping his glasses on the tail of his shirt.
We know when their transponder and communications died, Mark pointed out. A quick extrapolation of their course, speed, and estimated time of arrival at Tripoli International would have put the event just on Tunisia's side of the border, with the wreckage landing on Libya's.
Is that what you have there?
Juan asked, pointing to the desert imagery on the multi-panel display.
Murph shook his shaggy head.
No, we already checked it out, and nada. We saw an abandoned truck and a lot of tire tracks left by what we assume are border patrols, but no plane.
That's good news, then, Juan said. Her aircraft didn't suffer a mid-air explosion.
Good and bad, Eric replied. Since we don't know the nature of the event, it becomes much more difficult to figure out. Did the oxygen system fail and kill the crew, so the plane just kept flying until it ran out of fuel? If that's the case, it could have struck 500 miles or more to the east of Tripoli, possibly even in the Med. Or there could have been an engine failure. If that happened, the plane would have glided for miles before impact.
But that wouldn't explain the radio silence, the chairman pointed out. The crew would have radioed an emergency.
We know that, Mark said a little defensively. Still, we have to investigate every possible theory to winnow... Good word, huh? To winnow down our target area.
It's unlikely the radios would die the same moment as the engines, but stranger things have happened. Hey, that reminds me, have the feds talked to the ground people who serviced that plane last? You know, it could have been sabotaged. Lang said the FBI is conducting interviews as we speak. They should check out the flight crew, too. One of them could be Al-Qaeda or something.
The crew's all Air Force personnel, Juan replied. I doubt they are a security threat.
The CIA said the same thing about Aldridge Ames, and I'm sure the FBI had vetted Robert Hansen.
Despite his genius intellect, or maybe because of it, Murph delighted in pointing out the mistakes of others.
There's no reason some Air Force guy couldn't be bought. He could have flown the plane to some remote Libyan base where they're torturing the Secretary of State right at this moment.
He looked to Eric, his eyes a little glassy with inspiration.
What do you bet they're waterboarding her?
Good enough for the guys we have at Gitmo, right? Or they've attached electrodes to her...
Gentlemen, let's not get ahead of ourselves,
Juan interrupted before they started coming up with more lurid torture techniques.
Oh, sure, sorry, Eric muttered, even though he had remained silent during Mark's excited outburst.
Well, if both engines failed, we factored speed, altitude, and estimated a 1,500-foot-per-minute descent rate. That gives us a target area of roughly 80 nautical miles.
So that's what you have on the screen? Cabrillo asked.
Not exactly, Eric said.
Mark overrode his friend's next words.
Yes, we had to consider the engine failure radio dying scenario, but we discounted it pretty quickly and came up with something better.
Juan was losing patience with his brain trust, but he kept it to himself. He knew Murph and Eric delighted at showing off their intellect, and he wouldn't rob them of their fun.
So what's the answer?
The plane's tail came off.
Or at least part of it. Eric amended.
A structural failure in the tail could very likely damage the radio antennas, which would explain the blackout, Mark said. It could also knock out the plane's transponder at the same time.
Depending on the extent of the damage, Eric went on, the aircraft could still fly for some distance.
It would be highly unstable, and the pilot would have minimal control. He could only steer the plane by alternating thrust to each of its engines.
The danger comes from the fact the 737 doesn't have fuel dump capabilities. He would have had to fly in circles to burn off avgas or risk coming in too heavy.
Juan made to ask a question, but Mark anticipated him.
They refueled in London when they stopped for a quick meeting with England's foreign secretary. By my calculations, they had enough to keep going for at least an hour after the plane went dark.
Cabrillo nodded.
Even throttled back, she could have cruised for a couple hundred miles.
But they didn't, Eric said, or they would have tried an emergency landing in Tripoli.
Good point. So where the hell are they?
We combined two of our scenarios, engine failure and the tail coming apart, Mark said proudly.
It's plausible. Highly unlikely, but it could happen.
That narrowed our area to about 100 square miles. We found one potential spot, but it turned out to be a vaguely airplane-shaped geologic formation. He pointed to the center screen.
And there, we found that.
Juan stepped forward. The screen showed a mountainous area, nearly inaccessible to anything other than a chopper or a serious four-wheel drive. Mark hit a button on the panel's control, and the shot zoomed in.
There it is, the chairman whispered.
Near the top of one of the mountains was the plane, or what was left of it. The wreckage stretched for a half mile or more up the slope. He could see marks on the ground where it first impacted, rose up again, and then belly-flopped, tearing itself apart as it decelerated. Fire had scorched the ground about halfway between the second impact and the main debris site. The fuselage, at least the two-thirds of it that had stayed together, was a charred tube surrounded by the shredded remains of the wings. One engine lay 100 feet from the aircraft. Juan couldn't spot the second.
Any signs there were survivors, he asked, knowing the answer.
Sorry, boss man, Eric said. If there were, they haven't done anything to signal for help.
Mr. Overholt said we should be getting another set of satellite images in about 10 hours. We'll compare the two and see if anything at the site has changed. But look for yourself. It doesn't appear likely that anyone could have survived a crash like that. Not with the fire and all.
You're right. I know. I just don't like it. Fiona Katamora was one of the good ones. It's a damn shame for her to die like this, especially on the eve of the Tripoli Accords. The certainty that she was dead was like a heavy stone in the pit of Cabrillo's stomach. Listen, guys. Good work finding the wreckage. Zap a quick note to my computer with the exact coordinates so I can pass them on. No sense wasting the government's imaging specialist's time searching if we've already found her. I'm sure Lang's going to want us to investigate the site before reporting it to the Libyans. By the way, where are they searching?
They're off by a few hundred miles, Mark said. If you want my opinion, I think they're just going through the motions. They know we've got the satellite, so they're fumbling around until our government tells them where to look.
Probably right, Juan agreed.
Anyway, we've got to be able to get up there, and we can't use our chopper covertly, so map a route in for the pig.
Max doesn't like it when you call it that, Eric reminded.
He gave it the ridiculous name Powered Investigator Ground, so we'd call it the pig. He just grumbles about the nickname because he likes to grumble.
Juan tried to say this lightly, but his thoughts were on the victims of the plane crash. If he closed his eyes, he could imagine the terror they must have all felt as the plane was about to barrel into the side of the mountain. He wondered what Fiona Katamora's last thoughts were. An hour later, he was alone in his cabin, sitting with his feet propped up on his desk, a Cuban cigar between his index and middle fingers. He watched the smoke pool lazily along the coffered ceiling. Everything was set for their arrival in Tripoli the following night. He had gotten hold of a shadowy facilitator in Nicosia, Cyprus, who went by the name L'Enfant, the baby, a man Juan had never met, but who had contacts all over the Mediterranean. For a fee, the baby had made all the customs arrangements for unloading the pig. He had also gotten together the proper visas for the team Cabrillo would take with him into the mountains. Langston had been adamant that they verify that the Secretary of State was dead. Juan didn't relish combing the wreckage, but he knew they had to be certain. He again glanced at the hard copy of the satellite image sitting on his blotter. Something about the wreckage pattern bothered him, but he couldn't say what. He'd pulled up pictures of plane crashes from the internet and saw no obvious discrepancies. Not that any two crashes were identical, but there was nothing glaringly out of place. Still, there was something. With Cabrillo's fluency in Arabic, it was no surprise he had spent time in Libya during his years with the CIA. The two missions he'd been assigned hadn't been that dramatic. One had been helping a general and his family to defect. The other had been a secret meeting with a scientist who claimed he worked on Gaddafi's nuclear weapons program. It turned out the guy had virtually no useful information, so nothing came of it. Juan had liked the people he'd met and sensed that they weren't too keen on their government, but were too frightened to do anything about it. Such was life in a police state. He wondered if that had changed. Was Libya really opening up to the West, or did they still see us as enemies? For all he knew, both factions coexisted within the halls of power. He made a decision anyway. He wasn't going to trust that what happened to Katamora's plane was an accident until he heard the flight voice recorder for himself. And he wasn't going to believe she was dead until he saw the DNA result from the samples Langston wanted them to gather. He had been a success as a CIA agent because he had good instincts and knew to trust them. He'd done even better with the corporation for the same reasons. Something wasn't right, and he was determined to find out what.